One thing that most of you probably wouldn't know about me is that I often have very vivid dreams when I sleep at night. So vivid that there are times where I wake up feeling exhausted because of everything that's been going on in the dream. And my sleep doctor was quite concerned about this, that my quality of sleep wasn't good because of the vividness of these dreams. So he decided that I should have my brain scanned to find out if there are any neurological issues. I was relieved that the scan said that I did have a brain, so that was good. But I was also relieved when the scan said there were no sort of bad neurological issues. And at the end of the day, the doctor and I concluded that it might just be something to do with my job that I have these vivid dreams. Indeed, there is one clergyman that I know who retired a little while ago who apparently had similar things to me while they were serving, and then once they retired, it all just went away. It all just went away. So pray for me that my vivid dreams wouldn't tire me out too much. But sometimes as I have these vivid dreams, I find myself feeling troubled by what I dream. Not because I have nightmares per se. The last time I really had a nightmare with all sorts of monsters and stuff in it was just before a New Testament exam in second year at Bible college, when I'd drunk copious amounts of coffee to try and stay awake the night before to study. And just to put things in context, I don't drink coffee. And I certainly haven't drunk it since then, because the dreams I had after that were just bizarre. Now, the reason why I find myself troubled is because I find myself sometimes doing things in dreams that I just would never normally do. And I wake up going, oh, why did I do that? Friends, be assured that when we're asleep, the parts of our brains that cause us to inhibit ourselves is actually switched off. That's why we do things in our dreams that we normally wouldn't do. And so I find myself troubled by that. Well, friends, as we come to Daniel 7 today, we come to Daniel having a dream. In the past, it's been King Nebuchadnezzar who's had the dreams. Now Daniel has a dream, and it's a dream which troubles him. But as we look at Daniel's dream, we're going to see it's a message actually from God about the future. And it's a message which tells us that the future looks very, very bright at the end for those who are God's people. There's victory that lies ahead. But what we'll also see is that there are hard times that lie ahead before that victory comes. And so let's see how all this plays out now as we look at Daniel 7. And so what we see is that Daniel had a dream about four beasts and their eventual demise. All this takes place in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, which is around about 550 BC to 549 BC. We've heard about Belshazzar before. We heard about him in Daniel 5. Remember the story about the writing on the wall? That was Belshazzar. And so that was about 10 years on from this time when Daniel had a dream. So from Daniel 7 to 5, we're going back about 10 years. Now, we heard when we looked at Daniel 5 that Belshazzar was a co-regent over Babylon with his father Nabonidus. Nabonidus had gone away for a period of time. Belshazzar comes in his place. And one can't help but wonder if people in Babylon were a little bit concerned about this, if they perceived that things in Babylon might not be going so well now with Belshazzar in charge. 550 to 549 was also the time when King Cyrus of Persia conquered the Medes and they were swallowed up into his kingdom. And so it seems you have Babylon starting to weaken potentially and the Persians starting to emerge. And maybe, maybe just maybe, Daniel has all these things on his mind as he dreams. Notice that he wrote down the substance of his dream. Again, as I'm going to indicate, this is a message from God to him about what the future holds. And so Daniel writes this down to preserve this, and we benefit from it today. Indeed, as we'll look at this passage today, we're going to see how a very significant part of it has already been fulfilled, and that should give us great encouragement. The fact that Daniel preserved that helps us to see that God is the one who fulfills prophecy, and it should also help us, friends, to have hope about the future. That even though things now might not be great, it sets expectations in that way. Down the track, though, there's victory to come. So Daniel preserves this for us. Verse 28 makes it clear Daniel didn't really talk with others about this dream after he'd had it, but he certainly wrote it down. So its contents were preserved. Now, in verses 2 to 3, we read that Daniel says, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven, churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea." Now, before I go any further, I want to suggest that Daniel's dream is an example of apocalyptic literature. Apocalyptic literature. That is, it's not literalistic, okay? It's filled with symbols and it's filled with images that convey truths about certain things. The book of Zechariah is a very apocalyptic book. The book of Revelation is probably the best known of the apocalyptic books in the Bible. And the reason why this apocalyptic kind of language is used, apart from justifying my job, is it can be a way in which God reveals himself through images that we can comprehend. Because think about God, he's far bigger, far greater than our minds can conceive. And so apocalyptic imagery is God's way of helping us to learn important things about God. It could also be used at the time as code by people, as a way of conveying truth to other people of God, but in ways that others might not be aware of. And I think that's what you see in Revelation. And we see this apocalyptic sort of imagery conveyed, for example, with the use of beasts in this dream. This is a dream about beasts. But later on in verse 17, we're told that the four great beasts are four kings that will rise from the earth. So this image of beast is used to describe human beings who are kings and the kingdoms that they rule over. Notice too that these beasts come out of the great sea or the sea. And for the people of Israel, the sea symbolized chaos. It symbolized evil. And so straight away, as we think about these four great beasts, the expectation is we have things that are evil. When we have nightmares about great beasts, it's scary, right? It's not a comforting kind of idea. And again, this is the idea here. This is something that's not particularly comforting. In fact, what we're going to see is that these kings are described as beasts because they don't rule in the way in which God intends them to rule. Their rule is corrupt. Their rule is evil. Remember that as human beings, we were created in the image of God. And the idea of being created in the image of God was that we were created to rule over creation on God's behalf. But the problem with human beings is that we like the idea of ruling over God's creation, but not on God's behalf. And at the heart of that desire not to rule on God's behalf is what we call sin, or rebellion against the rule of God. And the problem with sin is that it turns human beings into beasts. It turns human beings into beasts. We don't function in the way in which God intended us to function. It makes us beastly. That's the idea. And so here we have these four beasts, great beasts, referring to rulers out of the sea, that is, they're evil. Now what I'm going to do is just highlight what verses 4 to 8 have to say about these particular beasts. But one thing I want to be clear about is that Daniel 7 doesn't tell us the identity of these beasts. It doesn't tell us the identity. Chapter 8, when it speaks about some other things, we'll talk about the identity of what's being referred to. But here, Daniel 7 doesn't do that. And lots of people speculate about what these beasts are in Daniel 7. You know, is it Babylon? Is it Media and Persia and Greece? Or is it Babylon and Persia and Greece and Rome? Or is it the United States and China and Russia and whoever else? Lots of people speculate about it. But friends, there's a sense where we waste our time doing that because the text simply doesn't tell us who is being represented. But we can certainly learn a lot about what these rulers will be like. And so let me highlight that as we look at verses 4 to 8. So notice that the first beast was like a lion and it had the wings of an eagle. So notice that detail. And friends, the combination of lion and eagle really highlights the majestic combination of strength and swift conquest. But notice too that this beast had its wings torn off and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human being was given to it. And friends, I think this transformation to being like a human being is a possible allusion to King Nebuchadnezzar's period of animal-like living and humbling before God in chapter 4. But it's interesting to note that verse 17 tells us that these four beasts are kings who will come. Who will come. So it's probably not referring to Nebuchadnezzar, but it might be that it's referring to some kind of king who has a Nebuchadnezzar-type experience, where they start out in a beastly way, but are humbled by God to become more human in the way in which they rule. In verse 5, we read about a bear, one that looks like a bear, and notice that it was raised up on one of its sides, and the beast being raised up on one side could symbolize a coalition where one side is more dominant than the other. But notice too that it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And I think that highlights the devouring nature of this ruler, a very bloodthirsty kind of ruler. Verse 6, we read about another beast that looked like a leopard that had 4 wings like those of a bird. And the wings on a leopard emphasize extreme speed and agility, pointing to a kingdom that conquers others rapidly. But notice too, it has 4 heads. And the 4 heads might represent 4 kings or a beast with great vision because it's got a number of eyes as a result of having those 4 heads. And then you have a terrifying, frightening, and very powerful beast in verse 7 that had large iron teeth that it crushed and devoured its victims, trampled underfoot, etc. And compared to the other beasts, the 4th beast is unmatched in violence, as it crushes and tramples all rather than simply conquering them. So remember last week I highlighted how it looked like the Persians, when they conquered the Babylonians, kept the kind of the Babylonian public service in place. It was just easy to do that. Well, this 4th beast is not like that. This dismantles everything, crushes everything, tramples everything, is the idea. And notice that it had 10 horns. And our passage itself actually helps us to interpret this because verse 24 tells us that the 10 horns represents 10 kings. Represents 10 kings. And then in verse 8, we read about another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and 3 of the first horns were uprooted before it. And that little horn, which uproots the 3 horns, represents another king subduing 3 kings. That's what verse 24 tells us as well. Notice that this little horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being, and that might be a way of suggesting a king with great vision. This little horn was also very boastful, as we're going to see in more detail in a moment. So there are the descriptions of these 4 different kings and the kingdoms that they represent. And apart from one which seems to experience transformation, the rest are beastly, bloodthirsty. Just crave power. Some just crush people beyond recognition. And so here Daniel receives a vision speaking about 4 kings to come. And on the whole, it's a bunch of rulers and a bunch of kingdoms that aren't great. Quite negative. But at this point, our focus in the vision moves from the sea and these beasts up to heaven. And notice in verse 9, as I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow, the hair of his head was white like wool. The Ancient of Days, this is a reference to God the Father. Ancient of Days, well, he existed before these four beasts and their kingdoms, and as we're going to see, he will exist after them as well. He has clothing that's as white as snow, indicating purity, righteousness, that kind of idea. His hair is white as wool. And again, I think it could indicate wisdom, but it's probably just a way of indicating he's been around a long time. He has been around a long time. Now, please, this is not a literal picture of what God looks like. Again, this is apocalyptic language, okay, that's trying to convey to us truths about God. Notice that his throne was flaming with fire and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. So fire conveys the idea of the presence of God. You see that in the book of Exodus with Mount Sinai, all ablaze. It conveys the idea of purification, of fury. Notice that the throne has wheels that were all ablaze. The Ancient of Days rule is not just stuck in one place. It goes everywhere. It goes everywhere. We notice that there are thousands upon thousands who are attending the Ancient of Days, who are standing before him. But notice the court was seated and the books were open. What's being described here is a time of judgment. And evidence has been carefully marshalled and recorded in books. And all of that will now be brought out into the open. The process that is going to occur will be a just process. God will judge justly, is the idea here. But notice as this judgment is going on, notice that Daniel says, I continue to watch because of the boastful words, the horn, that little horn on the fourth beast was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. So that little horn goes down speaking big. But he goes down. He's destroyed. But notice verse 12, the other beasts had been stripped of their authority but were allowed to live for a period of time. That sounds a bit strange in some respects. It could be that what's being described here is the idea that the kings or the kingdoms that were represented originally by those first three beasts have come to an end, but there are now still others like them that are out there. And when you think about our world today, it is filled with beastly rulers, is it not? With rulers who are just thinking about themselves, that inflict violence upon others, that treat others harshly, that abuse and misuse the power that they have. Our world is filled with beastly rulers. But then we come across a ruler who is not at all beastly in verses 13 and 14. In my vision at night, I looked and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. We've read about four beastly rulers, although one experienced transformation, but here is one who is not at all beastly. Here is one who lives as one truly in the image of God, one without any corruption whatsoever. And because this one has no corruption whatsoever, they are able to join with the Ancient of Days in ruling over all things. That's what verse 14 tells us. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. The four beasts will be destroyed. But this one, like a son of man, will rule forever. Now, friends, can I say to you that Daniel 7, 13 to 14 are two of the most important verses in the Old Testament when it comes to what the New Testament teaches us. Because what we see as we turn to the New Testament is that Jesus is the one like a son of man. He is the one like the son of man. Indeed, Jesus referred to himself as the Son of Man 30 times in Matthew's Gospel, 14 times in Mark's Gospel, 25 times in Luke's Gospel, and 12 times in John's Gospel. Jesus was very open about the fact that he's the fulfillment of Daniel 7 and what it says about the Son of Man. Indeed, the most prominent, I think, of these quotes is in Matthew 26, verses 63b to 64, where Jesus was on trial before the religious leaders. The high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God." "You have said so," Jesus replied. "But I say to all of you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Here, Jesus strongly alludes to the words of Daniel 7. He knows that he is about to die. These religious leaders will get their wish and Jesus will be put to death. But as we heard last week, Jesus, the innocent one, the one in whom there are no beastly qualities at all, was raised from the dead, vindicated by his Father as the innocent one. And he knew that he would ascend, he would come on the clouds to heaven and be given all authority, glory, and sovereign power by the Ancient of Days, and that he would rule forever. Here is Jesus speaking about exactly what was about to happen to him. And in Philippians 2, 9 to 11, we are told that's exactly what happened. After Jesus humbled himself by dying in our place, we are told God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow, and in heaven, on earth, and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Jesus is the King of Kings. He is the Son of Man who now rules over all things. And notice that a time will come when every knee will bow before him, when every tongue will acknowledge that Jesus is Lord. And that day will be the day of judgment, friends. And let me tell you that on that day, there are going to be some people who will be bowed down before Jesus and acknowledging his rule with great fear and dread in their hearts, because they had not acknowledged the rule of Jesus before that point. But there will be others who will bow before Jesus with great joy and with celebration declare that the one who has been their Lord is indeed the Lord of all, whose rule is now seen by all. And friends, the truth of the matter is, we really need to make sure that Jesus is our ruler now. Because those who accept Jesus now will be accepted by him on that day. Those who reject his rule now will be rejected by him on that day. And again, I just want to give you a bit of an insight into what the rule of Jesus is like and why it's actually such a good thing, a wise thing, to have him as your king now. In Matthew 11, 28 to 30, Jesus said, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened," probably weary and burdened by the beasts of our world, "and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light." Come to me, says Jesus. This is an invitation for us to make Jesus our ruler. He talks about the idea of take my yoke upon you. And on the screen here, we've got a picture of a yoke. A yoke was an instrument that you would put on oxen, and to make sure that the oxen would go in the direction that the master wanted them to go into. And Jesus is saying, take my yoke upon you. Learn from me. Submit yourself to my rule, to my teaching, and follow that. Now, friends, notice what the yoke is like. He says, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. See, as a ruler, we're told Jesus is gentle and humble in heart. The beasts that we read about in Daniel 7 are anything but gentle or humble. They use their power not for the good of others, but for their own good, no matter the cost to others. Well, that's not Jesus. And these powerful beasts often like to make people work hard for them. But notice what Jesus offers. Rest. I will give you rest, says Jesus. Rest for your souls that lasts for eternity. Some people think that having Jesus as your king, oh, that's so restrictive, that's not a good thing, I can't do what I want. Friends, having Jesus as your king is having the best king you could ever have. A king who is actually concerned for your welfare, who gives you teaching that is for your good. That's what he's like. And in fact, listen to what Matthew 20, 28 tells us about this king. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. It's interesting, Jesus didn't say, I did not come to be served. He said, the Son of Man. Jesus, again, is highlighting he is the Son of Man in Daniel 7, but let me tell you, if there was ever anyone that deserves to be served, it is the Son of Man who rules over all things. But notice that this Son of Man does not come to be served, but to serve. Because as we saw in Matthew 11, he is gentle and humble in heart. And when the Son of Man came to serve, he didn't come to serve those who were nice to him, who were good to him, who were kind to him. No, he came to serve his enemies who deserve punishment from him. But instead, he was the ransom. He paid the price to free us from that punishment we deserve so we could have eternal rest instead. Friends, at the end of the day, every knee will bow. Every tongue will acknowledge that Jesus is Lord. Friends, bow now. Acknowledge now that he is your Lord. And on that final day, you'll rejoice. But woe to those who refuse to come to Jesus now. Again, friends, he's not a beastly ruler like those rulers in Daniel 7. He is a gentle and humble ruler who gave his life for us. Come to him. Let's come back to Daniel 7. And what we see is that Daniel's dream revealed the oppression that God's people would face before they would share in the victory of his kingdom. So verses 15 to 18, I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. I approached one of those standing there, that is, one of those thousands that were in the heavenly court, and asked him the meaning of all this. So he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. The four great beasts are four kings that will rise from the earth. But the holy people of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. So ultimately, the beasts will be brought down. God's people will be raised up and enjoy the spoils of being a part of his kingdom forever. But Daniel wants to know more in particular about the fourth beast and about that little horn on the fourth beast. He wants to know more. I think it troubles him. Indeed, look at what he sees in verses 21 to 22. As I watched, this horn was waging war against the holy people and defeating them until the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the holy people of the Most High, and the time came when they possessed the kingdom. The interpretation of what Daniel saw here is given a few verses later. After them, another king will arise, different from the earlier ones. He will subdue three kings. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his holy people and try to change the set times and the laws. The holy people will be delivered into his hands for a time, times and half a time. We don't know exactly how long that is, but it's a limited period of time. But the court will sit, and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to the holy people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all his rulers will worship and obey him. So, friends, notice what happens to God's people before the great victory comes. Daniel is told God's people will experience oppression. The beastly ruler, particularly represented by the fourth beast, will defeat them. Will defeat God's people, we're told. It would happen for a limited time before the victory would come. But notice that before victory, there is oppression. And friends, we've seen over a study of the Christian church over the last couple of thousand years that persecution continues under beastly rulers even until today. That there are Christians who are forced in other countries around the world to meet in secret out of a fear of what police will do if they're caught. There are people who are arrested and put in jails, and some even die for the sake of following Jesus. And we should pray for our sisters and brothers around the world who are oppressed by these beastly rulers. And can I say, we should give thanks that we probably have less beastly rulers over us in our context. But anyone who says to you that becoming a follower of Jesus now will make your life easy is not speaking what the Bible speaks. Yes, victory is to come. But as Jesus' followers, we can expect that beastly rulers now will act against God's people. And so therefore, we need to make sure, friends, that we're encouraging one another to stand firm as followers of Jesus. That we're gathering together as we are today and reminding one another about the victory that will be ours in Christ. We need to keep reminding one another about what a magnificent ruler Jesus is and why it is so worthwhile to keep on following him no matter what. We need to help one another in that and keep pointing people to the light at the end of the tunnel, the victory that is to come. So, friends, Daniel 7 was a dream that troubled Daniel. And you can understand why. All these awful beasts, seeing God's people being oppressed and defeated. But there's victory there too, isn't there? There's victory for God's people eventually. And they'll be truly human, acting truly in the image of God, ruling on God's behalf over all things. And be encouraged for the way in which we've already seen verses 13 and 14 of this passage fulfilled. Jesus came, the one like a son of man, died in our place but was raised from the dead, has ascended into heaven and is now seated at the right hand. He's now the King of kings, the Lord of lords, the one to whom every knee will bow and every tongue will acknowledge that he is Lord. Let's keep following him no matter the opposition we encounter from the beastly rulers of our world today.